Hello and welcome to Launch. We're broadcasting live from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm your host, Ron Reardon. I'm joined in the studio by our producer, Lee Cantor. Good morning, Lee. How are you doing today?
I am doing okay. How about you? You promised the pollen was gone. Now we have different pollen that's invisible. It's not on my car.
That's
just
right.
In my lungs.
Yeah, but now you can wash your car.
Yes, okay? Thank you.
All right. Well, Lee, on Launch, we feature innovators, entrepreneurs, and related industries, you know, providing our listeners with the opportunity to learn from the successes and the failures of launching an idea and the journey that follows. This morning, we're featuring Nigel Flynn of Atlanta. But before we get started, Lee, could you thank today's sponsor?
Our sponsor today is Patents & More. Patents & More, protecting your innovation and connecting you to the resources you need for success.
Okay. Well, Nigel Flynn is going to be talking to us today about innovation in action. Nigel works as an innovation professional at the interface of both science, technology, and business. He devises and develops new products for companies and builds real value into those products and the companies that sell them. He also consults globally with businesses ranging anywhere from size from startups all the way up to Fortune 500s. You know, his first job in the corporate world gave him the highly desirable title of corporate inventor for a European-based multinational corporation. And, you know, the story of how he came to win that job and what happens next is the kind of story that would be the ambition of anybody with a passion for innovation. Nigel joins us today to talk about his experiences, you know, innovating for major corporations and his current work, you know, as an innovation professional consulting with companies, you know, both large and small to bring technology from science and business success from innovations within technology. Nigel, welcome to the Launch Hour.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Okay. Innovation is a word that's tossed around a lot, you know, open innovation and like that. But what does innovation mean and what is innovation?
Yeah, I was very interested in this question because it's a word that I see so frequently and I think about what it means in my own life quite a lot because today I'm confronted by a lot of ideas that are created by other people, and they have some idea of the forward motion of those ideas into products, into services, into systems or procedures. And I think that the word innovation really is the place where the rubber hits the road. It's the place at which that idea is made workable in the market, and the real value of the idea comes into being through the application of possibly technology or other kinds of ideas related to bringing that idea to life.
Now, is innovation something that you think can, are you born with this, or is this something you can be taught? What has been your experience in this? Are some people just more innovative than other people, or can a corporation really tap into the masses of people in their organization and really make them innovative?
Yeah, I've really struggled with this question. I honestly am not sure that I fully know the answer to it. I've been whenever you're sitting in a bar and you tell somebody what you do for a living, that you work at the interface of ideas, that you devise and develop new products, you seem to become a magnet for people who have just an absolute font of ideas. I've met people who tell me that every day of the year they generate a new idea that they believe might generate a saleable product. And when you talk to people like this in detail, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that they possess some special faculty that allows them to create these ideas. And I usually sit down with them, by the way, and give them some sense of how they might best tap into their own creativity. But I have also found that there are systems and processes that greatly enhance an individual and an organization's ability to be able to innovate. And interestingly enough, I'm not convinced that we do a good enough job in the educational world in preparing people for the world outside of academia to be innovative. I actually think we spend a lot of time injecting knowledge into people and some time helping people to solve problems, helping to teach people to solve problems. But I'm not sure that we teach innovation to everybody going through the educational system in the way that we should do. I personally found myself completely flat on my face when I was first expected to innovate. Just as a background and a sort of a personal experience in my case, I studied a degree in pure chemistry and was given no indication at all that I might eventually be working at the interface of ideas, and eventually decided that the best thing for me to do was the most demanding thing that I could do with my life, and that for me was to move into university research. And it suddenly occurred to me on day one that I was completely ill-equipped to be able to innovate myself and travel through an area of research that was both exciting and interesting, but in which it was clear that I needed to be very creative in order to be successful.
Well, I know there's different levels of innovation. I mean, there's incremental improvements, and then there's real game changers. I mean, when you look at incremental improvements, it's like, well, we've got coffee. What if we add, you know, a flavor to that coffee? That's just kind of a, you know, incremental change. But then there's game changers, you know, like the iPod or the iPhone and things like that. That was just like, you know, whoa, you know, this is something, you know.
Sure. Yeah, I couldn't help reflecting on that as I was traveling here this morning, because I looked at an email from you at about 6:30 this morning, Ron, with the address of this location, and it suddenly occurred to me that if I looked at the same email on my iPhone, I could just simply put my finger on the address, and immediately a map would pop up with the location, and then it would show my current position and how to drive from my current position to the final location.
And that's a lot different than pulling out the old folding map and trying to figure out where things are.
I'll say.
Yeah,
tremendously convenient to be able to access this information.
Yeah, if somebody's got stock in a company that makes maps, you know, I think you might need to sell. You know,
what about if you have stock in a company that makes GPS devices?
Well, sure. Or makes GPS devices better. I think I might need a GPS device to deliver me back through the corridors of this building to this office.
Yeah. Well, Nigel, when did you first discover that you had a flair for innovation?
Well, it really began for me during the research process. It suddenly occurred to me that there were some very big problems, challenges associated with what we were trying to do in terms of, in this case, just work in a very abstruse area of cellulose chemistry, which didn't seem to be important to anybody at first, except some very academic areas of the papermaking industry, until it suddenly started to occur to us that we were exploring an area of technology that had the opportunity to turn cellulose into ethanol. And that suddenly got the attention of British Petroleum, and that brought a lot of funding into the lab in which I was working. And through a combination of hard work and also, I believe, some great ideas that we had at the time, we were able to show British Petroleum how to take some major steps in biotechnologically purifying cellulose so that it could be turned into ethanol. And that resulted in a worldwide patent, which they insisted on filing immediately for the work. So that sort of tipped me off to the idea that the way in which you thought about a subject was maybe more important than how much you knew about the subject.
Yeah, and it can really spawn a huge industry.
Okay? Oh, yes.
And have a major impact on the economics of the world.
Absolutely. But I think that the moment for me that was an extraordinarily important defining moment was that I was recruited to my first position in industry as an innovator, and I was tremendously exultant that I'd succeeded in being offered this position, because about 200 people applied for the job, and many were interviewed, and I was interviewed about four times for it. But I actually wound up having no office, and so I was placed in the company library, which was great for me. I was surrounded by books. And a couple of months went by, and I was gathering information on the company and its manufacturing capabilities. And the brief of the position was that the company had been in business for about 20 years, had a range of products, some of which were extremely successful in the marketplace. But the people who'd started the company had kind of run out of ideas. They'd been exposed to that industry sector for about 20 years. And they thought that it was a great time to bring somebody new into the business who simply hadn't been exposed to the market sector before and might be able to identify areas in which the manufacturing technology could be used to create new products that would bring entirely new markets to the company. And I sat around for a couple of months gradually gathering information, and there was no pressure on me initially. But as time went by, it suddenly started to occur to me that if I didn't have that great first idea, that something untoward was going to happen sooner or later. And it was very, very interesting indeed that the company had the ability to change the physical properties of materials in various ways. They had the ability to change the electrical properties of materials, as well as change the chemically absorbent properties of materials. And they'd done a great deal with chemical absorbency. They'd actually created what is called the nuclear chemical and biological warfare suit that had become the standard of the British Ministry of Defense and also the American Navy, the U.S. Navy. This was an absorbent material that was designed to absorb a broad range of chemicals that might be used in chemical warfare.
You know, it's so important to bring somebody in from outside. Yep. Whenever I reflect on the Starbucks story, you know, the original Starbucks people were three guys that were literary majors. And they just sold beans. And when Charles Schulz joined them, he says, "You guys really should have a coffee shop." And they're like, "No, no, no, we just do beans, you know." And he ended up leaving the company, and then they decided to go into tea, and he ended up buying Starbucks and changing his, you know, the stores that he'd started for coffee into Starbucks. But it's real important to have somebody from outside come in and see a different perspective and a different business value.
Yes, exactly. It started to occur to me, these guys have done so much in chemical absorbency, but here are some remarkable things that they can do with the electrical properties of material. And I was getting fairly desperate. I knew I was in the right area, but the idea had not come to me. And I was staying late in the company. I was sitting in the library until 11 o'clock at night. And one evening, I was sitting there in a state of something close to desperation. And I was looking at a piece of glass, and the piece of glass split light into the seven colors of the spectrum. And it started to make me think about the first lessons that I'd had at school about how when light passes through a block of glass, it's refracted. And then it's refracted as you move from one medium to another, from air to glass and glass to air. And it started to make me think about the fact that a very small amount of the light that impinges upon that surface is reflected. So 95% of the light would pass through if the angle was correct, and 5% of it would be reflected. And I started to think not about the 95%, but about the 5%. And then, instead of having just one layer, and one density of material, if you had many layers of different densities and you started to get that 5% effect over and over and over and over again as the light was passing through, what would happen? And then, because I recognized that radar comprises a part of the electromagnetic spectrum that in essence is identical to light, but is just operating at a different wavelength, that I could do the same in the range of radar. And so I went away and did calculations that suggested some idea of the range within which the materials should perform and the thickness that the material should have. And I put together a whole series of composites. And I had very little confidence in what I was doing, so I decided not to tell anybody. But through my connections back with the university, I had a friend who'd gone to the Royal Signals and Radar Establishment in Malvern, in Great Britain. And I called him up and I said, look, I'm going to send some materials. Can you just test them for their radar absorbent properties? And just give me a sense of direction on this thing. So I sent three materials through the mail. And a letter went out to me, but a phone call came before the letter arrived. And it was my friend, and he said, we've tested all three materials, and I can't remember the order of them, but he said something like, A and B are not really very interesting, but the director of RSRE wants to speak to you immediately about number C. And I said, what? And he said, you need to pay attention to this. And I said, really? And he said, I think you need to be considering a patent. And so we immediately retained a patent attorney. And the patent attorney explained to me, look, as soon as you get this onto paper, you're going to get an MOD secrecy order placed on the patent because this is what Her Majesty's government would refer to as prejudicial to the defense of the realm. Wow. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, well, it means we don't want it in the hands of people who might hurt us. And so it began. And that was a defining moment for me. That was where I discovered that thinking sideways about a project, thinking more broadly about information that you already have at your fingertips, was some part of the essence of innovation.
Well, that's a real logic leap to go from, you know, the spectrum of visible light, you know, to working, you know, with you know, radar.
Yeah.
And is the key learning there that you need to be sleep deprived
in
order to come up with innovation?
Well, I used to argue that I did my best thinking late at night, and that was because in the pre-internet era, at least, there was a very, very little distraction. There was nobody in the building, but it was a big old Victorian building, and it hummed day and night. And I always found that hum of production to be an incredibly exciting thing. So I used to like to be there and feel that kind of vibration like a ship late at night and be there alone, the ideas guy, thinking about what might happen in the future. And I was at a point of about 3 or 4 months where people were thinking, he's gone, he's out of here. And then suddenly my stock rose from virtually zero to being talked about in the boardroom of the multinational. We've got this guy called Flynn. He's come up with this idea. And then I just enjoyed this period of a tremendous flourish. I realized that there were a great many other military applications for the materials that this company had the potential to make. So I started to create materials that changed the radar signature of objects and started to become very heavily involved with the Ministry of Defense in Great Britain, because once they discovered they had a resource, then they brought their challenges to us. And we opened up an entire area of business with miraculous consequences in some cases.
And that's really the power of a single idea. But Nigel, is innovation by itself enough to guarantee business success?
Well, that's a tremendous question. And for those of us who work in the technology area, you very rapidly discover the importance of all the other functions and disciplines that are necessary to get an idea away from that that prototype and to the marketplace. And if I were to look at the story of my own life, I have to tell you that I believe that that's the central reason that I'm in America today. Great Britain has a superabundance of people with great ideas. But this country, America, is for me the country that is most advanced in taking ideas and turning them into commercial products. It is most advanced in the marketing sale of a product, defining the customer, their needs, and the end-use applications that might be most attractive. And it's those skill sets, I think, that set some of many skill sets, but those skill sets in particular that set America apart for me. And when I first started to travel to this country, I was immediately impressed by the way in which people took ideas as something that was living and breathing and extremely important. And, of course, by extension, they tended to treat the person with the idea a little better than they were.
Now, can you share, because you have been around the world, why do you think it is that America embraces innovation the way that it does? Do you think it's just part of its DNA?
I think I might have talked to Ron about this. I have a personal theory about the fact that many nations in the world possess an indigenous population that just were born into that culture. But in the case of the United States over the last 200 years, this culture has been has had associated with it a self-selection process. There were many people who discovered through, in one way or another, that a better life might await them in this new and exciting culture where there was an optimism about the future, where there was an ability to be able, I call it the frontier spirit, an ability to be able to take your own piece of land, carve out a future for yourself. But in order to do that, you had to be innovative at the at a grassroots level to ensure that you had a supply of water, to ensure that you had food to eat. And
you had to be a risk taker, that you would abandon your wherever
absolutely.
You came from. So that you inertly, you are a risk taker.
Absolutely.
Which is one of the keys to innovation.
That's
right?
A great point you make there. Yes, absolutely. And I can't help but relate this to my own life, because I remember being surrounded by a sea of baggage. In fact, it was Huntsville Airport in Alabama one Sunday night, thinking, my God, what have I done? Because I was in the United States. I just arrived. I did have a consultancy position to go to, fortunately. But there was a sense of Ellis Island. I know I came via Delta Airlines and the INS people were extremely friendly and actually very welcoming when they said, what do you do for a living? I said, well, I'm an inventor. I believe I devise and develop new products that are important. And he said, well, you are truly welcome in this country, which was great thing
welcome,
to hear.
Right?
I don't think they were necessarily quite as friendly on Ellis Island from what I've read. But I do think that yes, inherent in that risk-taking that brings people to the country, inherent in that DNA is a desire to look at what's new and what's next, what's better. There is an early adopting character in the culture of the American people, which I think is stronger here and definitely drives innovation. There is also tremendous business practicality, which comes out of this wonderful melting pot of many cultures successful in business. I mean, ethnically, peoples from all over Europe that have come and defined what America is today. I don't know if I'm answering the question, but somewhere within these thoughts and ideas, I think there's an explanation that there's something unique about it.
Right. It's unique. I think that it's that combination of you have the different ethnicities all piled together in one place. We have, you know, like you said, these people were self-selected. They left wherever they were from. They risked everything. They, you know, traveled by boat across an ocean to get here.
Absolutely.
You know, putting their lives and families' lives at risk. So that's a unique personality trait. That's not a random person. And then they get here, and then they have the opportunity. And here, I think there's a meritocracy where there's no shame in failing. Where in some cultures, you get one shot at the brass ring, and if you don't make it, you know, you're a peasant somewhere the rest of your life or dead.
That's absolutely true. I certainly felt that I was on that day that I described where I was almost gone from the company, desperately shooting at that brass ring, and there was a great deal of pressure associated with it as well, and a tremendous sense of ecstasy when I realized that I'd done something of importance, and I'm almost embarrassed to tell you that the educational system through which I came did not prepare me to be an innovator at all, but by accident, I found myself doing that.
Okay, that's cool.
That'll be your novel, The Accidental Innovator.
The Accidental. Well, Nigel, how can our listeners get in touch with you?
We will leave resources through your website that make it possible for anybody who'd like to discuss with me their innovation or bringing products to market to be able to talk further. I feel as though I haven't really talked anything like enough about the range of things that I've been involved in.
We'll invite you back. You'll have
that's right. we'll give you a return visit.
Well, very good.
Yeah. Well, thanks for being on the show today, Nigel. Our listeners have gotten some really great nuggets and learnings that they can use in their launch and their journey. It's another great show, Lee.
Special thanks to today's sponsor, Patents and More, your trusted guide through the innovation jungle.
And tune in each week at this same time to listen live or go to our website, thelaunchhour.businessradiox.com, to listen at your convenience. Until next week, I'm Ron Reardon with our producer, Lee Cantor, signing off another great session of Launch.